I'd like just to ask you for a moment to do a creative imagination exercise with me, okay? It'll take a minute. But think of a time when you were wondering about saying something difficult, good or bad, to a friend, a partner, a boss, a colleague, whatever. And how you rehearse it in bed at night, what you're going to say, on the bus, you go over it 1,000 times until you think, okay, I've got this just right. And then the moment comes and you chicken out. You don't say it. Or you get the words wrong and you don't put quite the emphasis or the slant on it that you'd actually hoped. Any of you remember that? Mm-hmm. And how it feels? Well, I think for people who stutter, it's like that more or less every time they open their mouth. They're not quite sure if it's going to come out the way they intend. And it's tough. Obviously, for some people, there's a higher probability of that than others, depending on the degree of the stammer, the stutter. And people learn all sorts of ways of controlling it. But that, at its root, is it. Will I actually communicate what I intend to communicate? And part of our voyage together has been around, well, let's find out what is communicating other than what you intend. Just because some of you may not be familiar with stuttering, this is a typical self-assessment profile, which is done by your average speech pathologist, where people actually look and do a self-assessment. And I'm just going to very quickly go through to give you an idea of some of the complexity. It's like a syndrome that essentially anyone who has a stutter, there's an intention to speak, but there is something which is inhibiting that, which is traditionally called the block. And that block can occur anywhere from the diaphragm through to the lips. And it can even affect whether the oral intake is sucked in or out. So absolutely, and it can affect the whole lot or it can affect at any point. And it's usually very complex pattern. So just to give you an idea, there's looking at the frequency of the stutter. How often in an hour, in a day, in a week does somebody actually do it? There's a type of physical struggle during the stammer. So some people go, and others would just go, which is less of a struggle. There's the duration of it. How long does it actually last? There's uncontrollable stutters. We paradoxically, 2 days before we came out here, we saw a program in the UK. And there was one lad who was just, he wasn't a lad, he was about 22, but he kept trying to say something. And he was going to say it, and they said, I can't do it. And then he'd try again. He would say, I can't do it. Now, that was a very extreme form of an uncontrollable stutter. There's the urgency and the fast speech rate. Some people think if they say it's terribly, terribly fast, they'll be able to get it out before the stutter catches them up. So they sort of go terribly fast. There's associated facial and body movements. So that on what happens is it builds up. You know how if you have a backache, you compensate so that you start doing something different, or if you've got a sore hip, you start, and so there's this complex thing which builds up. It's the same with a stutter. So that one day somebody finds that by stamping their foot and pushing through, they actually are fluent. So then that stamping the foot gets incorporated into the pattern. So sometimes you have a very, very complicated mixed pattern which goes on. There's the general level of physical tension. Some people have a very loose stammer, and it doesn't seem to bother them very much. And some people's whole body gets absolutely stiff and really contorted. Loss of eye contact is a very, very common thing, that people just are so caught up and embarrassed and what have you that they don't actually make eye contact with you. There's the thoughts, the negative thinking that you might have before, during, or after speaking. So your anxiety before you speak, your anxiety during the speaking process, or the way you beat yourself up afterwards. So, you know, different people are prone to different patterns there. There's the feelings you have about it: frustration, embarrassment, fear, anger, helplessness. I remember one woman we both worked with in Edinburgh, and she was such a... She was the sort of woman who was really interested in people. And if she had been able to, she would have gossiped on every street corner with everybody and known what was going. But she felt so helpless because she never quite knew if she was going to be able to do what she wanted to do. There's avoidance, which is a classic. People avoid words. You'll see somebody typically with a stutter going to say, well, actually, my name is, I'm called, my parents called me. That's all ways of trying to avoid actually to get in, and they'll actually do it in the moment. Avoiding the phone, avoiding talking about it, tends to be taboo often, except within self-help groups and things like that, but actually talking about it with other people, admitting it to yourself. This is a biggie. The disadvantages at home, socially, people in the pub have a habit of looking at you as if you're mad. Sorry, crazy. We decided I shouldn't say that because that means angry. Yeah, in the bar. Yeah, in the bar, they think you're crazy. Educationally, kids get bullied like hell. That's in educational systems. At work, I've spoken to senior and middle managers who suddenly get moved sideways. It's like a glass ceiling that they hit, and there's no real explanation for it. They're totally competent. So that just gives you flavour, some of the complexity of it. And then a more traditional approach would identify this pattern, this stammering pattern. It would aim to desensitize, as Lane was saying, various things like prolonged speech, slowing down, loose repetition, soft attack. No, that's the modify, sorry. The desensitize would be to make you feel better about actually speaking on the phone or speaking with people. So that would be a typical approach.
Kind of similar to process work, actually, in terms of being able to really bring awareness and unravel the experience using really neutral, non-judgmental descriptors. These are really neutral, non-judgmental descriptors. And there's something great about that. So we approach the stutter actually the same way any speech pathologist at the beginning, identifying the pattern, focusing very minutely on what's going on the person's experience, and somehow getting a clear experience of what's happening in the other person. If you can't feel it and recreate it yourself and have a felt sense of it, then you're not quite there yet. And then, as Claire was starting to talk about, differentiate what's more primary from what's more secondary. What's the intention, and what is stopping that intention? So the intention to speak and the blocker. And that, to me, is one of the most fascinating and complex things. Because as Claire was talking about, the person who is stuttering tries a variety of coping strategies to try to get through the block. And those coping strategies get incorporated in the stutter itself. And so when you're working with somebody and they're doing all of these things, they're tapping themselves or they're making faces or they're moving or and they're having all of these things, identifying, so which parts of that are actually trying to get away from the symptom and which parts are more central to the symptom itself. And it's very similar to what we're doing in process work all the time with movement, for instance. You know, if somebody, you know, you all know this, if somebody is stretching, you know. One way is to like help them to stretch more, and also important is to find out what are they stretching against. So for instance, to go behind them and inhibit them so that they get a sense of the tightness, for instance, that they're trying to stretch against. So it's very similar with the stutter. It's like, so which parts are the really hard horrible things and which parts are the things that they're that they consider horrible, and which parts are the parts that they're trying to do to alleviate that difficult experience. So getting to the center or the root of the problem. So there's all kinds of facial grimaces and tapping and stuff like that. Obvious stuff about channel experiences that there's talking, so that's verbal channel, there's auditory components of it, but often there's like a proprioceptive aspect of it and a movement aspect of it. So Bob. Bob had a really... rather than me giving a description...
show it.
I'll show his stuff. He would prolong his vowels, and it would like rise in the pitch. So it was like, and his voice would break at the top, and he would like raise his head and like put his head back. And at the beginning of the consonants, he would close his eyes, and there would be like a silence where he would like close his eyes or look up, and then he would like break through that, and he would say, "My name is Bob," like that. That was what his stutter was like, and he would like tap himself, and it was like loud, and it was pretty wild. So he got tight in his throat. He felt tight down his spine. So I asked him to speak and hold that stutter, and I asked him, what was he experiencing when he did that? And he said he experienced a tingling around his heart. So I said, what about the hands and the eyes? And he said, are those more coping strategies? He said, yeah, those are things I've learned over time to get through that initial block, and my experience of the block is like a tingling in my heart. So that tingling, that's what Arnie was talking about yesterday in terms of those minimal signals. That was like a really, you know, there was the obvious signals that we could see, and then there were those minimal signals inside that only he could experience, the tingling around the heart. So we amplified his awareness of that and allowed that tingling to spread. And he said it was like it spread all the way down his legs and into his body, and it started to make him shake. So he started to shake, and as he was shaking, he was like shaking like this and like holding his hands at the same time as he was shaking. So that's a double signal, obviously. There's like a big shaking going on, and there's a holding that's going on. So it seems like something is shaking and something is holding that in. So I came around behind him and I grabbed my hands over his hands and my arms around his arms and tight to his side, after asking, of course, to pick up that double signal. And he started to shake more, and I picked up the double signal also verbally by saying to him in a stern voice, "Hold it in." And then in a supportive, gentle voice, "Let it out. Hold it in. Let it out." Because there was all this. And I noticed his elbows starting to go like that. So I said, "Oh, what are your elbows doing? Follow those elbows." So he finally like broke out.
With a roar.
Well, first he broke out, but it was a breakout, but it wasn't quite much, with a bit of a roar. And I said, "Whoa. Was there a word that went all along with that?" And he immediately heard the word "fuck off." So I said, "Well, let's try that again. Maybe, I don't know. It could be interesting to hear that word too. Who knows?" So he did it again, and I really held him in, and finally he like... Sorry about that to the sound man over there. "Fuck off!" And he started... And he was like this incredible explosive burst of energy. And then like he ran to the corner and he like curled himself into a ball and he started to sob. Mm-hmm. And then he got up and he said, I was just grieving being small, but I'm done with grieving. I'm done with that. And he came back in the middle of the circle, and he put his hands up like that. And he said that he felt this incredible energy coming from the tension that he had always felt in the back of his neck, like rising up like that. And he was just like, rah, like that. And then we took a break after that for lunch, and he went out into the square in Edinburgh, and he just started to scream with everything inside of him, and people walking by, and he was just screaming and yelling and having, woo! It was like amazing. 2 years later, he came back to one of our stuttering workshops, and he said that he had been free of stuttering for the last 2 years, for the most part. And he was talking about his freedom to express himself that he had never had before, that he was unselfconscious. He said there was a place in his belly that had been like a sea that had been stormy his whole life. And that was calm now. It was like a calm sea. Mm-hmm. So what's fascinating to me about that work was that his stutter had been, in a way, the embodiment of his lack of freedom to express himself and to be himself. It was a sense of being held back and restrained, and he had to throw that off in order to have a breakthrough, throw off the restraint. But in a way, when we got to the root of the stutter, down to its original seed and helped that seed grow, that's what helped him to be free, actually. That it wasn't like, okay, now just be free. He'd been trying to be free for all of his life, but it's getting to the root of that lack of freedom, that tingling that he had always felt that allowed him finally to be free of that. Yeah. And I told him this last week when I called him up and asked him if it was okay, and he said, I never thought about it. That's exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right on my... wondering runs to wondering if there's some traditional talk therapy also that went along with this experience of the body and this tingle. Was there some talk about connection to his life story, the mythic piece of being trapped or held down or anything like that? That comes
to tell you the truth, we didn't talk about it there. We didn't talk about it there. I mean, that took a long time to unfold the whole thing, and we were on a schedule in our thing, but that would be actually, but to tell you the truth, when I talked to him a week ago, he said that was years ago, actually, when we did this work. He said that slowly his stutter has come back a little bit, not to the same extent, and so I was working with him on the phone just a little bit and asking him to stand in that same position. And he said, well, I feel like there's something that wants to really make a sound, but I feel like I can't because of my neighbors. So I said, well, that could be something interesting actually to work on also. So he said, oh, maybe it's finally time for me to work on that part of it. Like, what is actually inhibiting me in the culture, you know, living in the UK and his family scene. So actually, I think that's coming. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. I just also want to say, as we've already said, the stutter doesn't always go away, and it often doesn't. It's often a chronic symptom, and in this example, it happened to go away. But anyway, there's a huge value in unfolding that block.
We were going to give some different examples of different types of patterns that we found, but I'll jump straight to one which I think answers your question as well, because that particular example was where the stutter is like helping the person to access that deeper power inside of them and to come out, some sort of breaking through the resistance. But one of the examples we have here, which is what you're talking about, I was working with a man, and his pattern was something more like this. And so we held it and amplified it. And I said, yes, really feel that. And he said, yes, it's like a wall. But he said, the wall is here in front of him. There are other examples we have where somebody actually becomes the wall. He said, the wall is here in front of me. And I was watching him, and I looked at him. And the way he did this with his hands, I got the sense that the wall was huge and he was little. And I said, how big are you in relation to the wall? And he said, oh, I'm about a third of the size of this wall. So I said, well, how big are you? And he said, well, I'm probably about this big. He described it as a prison wall. And then he said, I'm probably about this big. And then a whole childhood story came out. So sometimes you get straight into some sort of frozen state, some piece of past history, which is right there, and it comes out. And so very quickly one's in with a past story and bringing that into present time. And it's very obvious that's where you need to go. But I've worked with many, many, many adults with stammer now, and sometimes it's more relevant and sometimes not. It's sometimes people definitely want to go to bits of past history. More often than not, it's related to past bullying, actually. When they're older, when their stammer's already established, but traumatic things which have actually happened at school or something like that. But yeah, we're going to give a few more examples as well. Another example of a different type of pattern is one that we call the... it was this man's words himself of going to the nitty-gritty. And it was... His stammering pattern was such that he had a block, a laryngeal block here, and his diaphragm. So the whole of this area here would tense right up, and he'd stand very straight and very tall, and his head would go right down. And when we asked him to say more about what was happening, he said that the impulse to speak was sort of here under his diaphragm, but it felt as if this whole area was just closing right up and wouldn't let this come out. And so as we unfolded this, he went right down into this place here. And this was... I didn't have the vocabulary for this then. I would now say he was going to a sentient experience. He called it going to the nitty-gritty. He had to go right down deep, 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 deep inside of himself. And when he actually had this, there was like a... Unlike Bob, who had to push against it, once he touched this, somehow that whole tension disappeared. And he... said, okay, now when I have this nitty-gritty, from there I can speak. And it was a very touching piece of work. 2 weeks later, this man died. Wow. 2 weeks later, he was riding, he used to have a motorbike, and he was overtaking a lorry truck, and it didn't see him turning, it didn't see him and tried to turn, and he was killed. And I always felt that they were deeply connected, that somehow that something in him was really trying to go to a very, very deep place. Nice man.
Tell the Parliament one.
Yeah. There's another guy. This is more, it feels like this one is more, we found five different expressions of a stuttering pattern. This is more like an ally figure. And this man, not a million miles from Bob in his pattern, he would go... yes! And it would be this rising pattern. It was very dramatic. And we got him to amplify it. And it turned out that he loves singing. And... what came out was a sort of this dramatic operatic character, and he would stop just doing that. He's the singer, not me, but he was doing this fantastic pattern. And this man worked for the local parliament, Scottish Parliament. This man's job was to go and give information to ministers and what have you. And he was frequently performing in that sense. And it was like this figure, when we took it out and amplified it, he said, it's saying to me, come out and speak your truth or you can't speak at all. And he really actually to be who he was in his big self. And he transformed. He used to go around. Do you remember it's the American TV, Columbo? Do you remember that? He used to be a bit of a Columbo character with his sort of shabby raincoat and sort of going around. And he suddenly sort of looked twice his size and was really sitting in his own power and communicating strongly. And that was another pattern. You were going to give another example,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I love that one.
Yeah. It was nice.
So this was another gentleman who, he was this big bear of a man. He was like this big guy, but he would like, had kind of stooped over shoulders and his head down, and he had this really, every few words he would just be totally stopped from speaking. And with this guy, rather than working with the block itself or with the physical experience, like some of the things we've been talking about, what he was interested in was, he said that the block was just a wall. He said, my stutter is a wall. It's too high to get over. It's too low to get under. Mm-hmm. It's too wide to get around. There's a song like that.
Stutter in the yeah. It feels like thunder. It's Michael Jackson.
Too high to get over.
Yeah.
right. I was thinking of an old Motown tune. But anyway, it was serious for this guy. It was like really... It was really intense, and the way he was describing the block was so intense that rather than working with the physical aspect, I just said, okay, so if you can't get around this wall, you can't get through this wall, you can't get over this wall or under this wall, be the wall. So I said, what's that like to be the wall? And from this, it was an amazing, slow physical transformation. He just went. Don't fuck with me. No stutter. Mm-hmm. Not a trace of it. Mm-hmm. So I started to push against him and say, but I want to get through you. You know, I just did it. Organic role switch. I want to get through you. I got to get around you. I hate that you're blocking me from speaking all the time, he said. Don't even try. And it was amazing from this point of view. And then we did do more of a talk therapy kind of thing, and realizing how in his life he was such a pushover and how he was always feeling like he was getting pushed around in his life and historically, and how this huge, insurmountable wall was something that, how much he needed that, actually.
He needed the wall because he
normally, he felt like he was always getting pushed around. He always felt like somebody would want to do something. He was like, okay. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, oh, that's right, you can go.
Wow.
And this thing was just like, no way you're going through me. Like, you can try, but don't you? I was actually literally trying to push the guy, and I felt like, I mean, the guy was big and strong. I felt like I was a gnat trying to push a mountain. It was like so, you know, and the guy was just, he loved it. That experience of like, don't fuck with me.
Isn't that interesting? The wall there is a developmental piece. At one point earlier in his life, it helped and was an ally for him. But as he grew up and then became the stutterer, then it became not the ally anymore and something he had to work through.
Well, I don't know if the wall had been an ally for him or something that he experienced. I mean, it was an ally in the sense of that we talk about in process work, that it's something that is not that he experiences as threatening and dangerous for him and something that he suffers from, but when he picks up its energy, he wrestles with it and picks up its energy, then it turns into an ally. That's what he needs. He always felt, even as when he was little, like he was getting pushed around. But then there was this stutter that came, and it was this big wall that he couldn't get through. And then, because he had a stutter, then it probably, I imagine, made him even more stepping back and you know, more pliant and shy. So I would say it that way.
We were going to say a little bit about the World Channel aspect of this, if that's okay, yeah? Because the very fact that it's a speaking process, obviously it's in relationship and the World Channel, as well as auditory, kinesthetic, properception. So it's a very complex thing. I've heard of some people stuttering in their sleep, but most people report that when they're talking to themselves, they're completely fluent. In their imagination about a context, they may not be. But when they're actually just talking to themselves, I've usually heard people say that they're fluent.
And usually people saying that also. Sorry.
Usually, yes. Yes.
You mean if you're talking aloud to yourself?
Yes. The way, like I do, oh God, why have I come upstairs? I can't remember what I came for. Often, usually. And in dreams, it can be either fluent or non-fluent. So there's that's just an interesting...
But so relational.
Yeah.
But that's performance related then?
Very much so. Very identity related. Lots of people who stutter if they act don't. If they're musicians, when I was a speech therapy student, a friend of mine had a really severe stammer at times. And he knew I was a speech therapy student. As soon as I came along, this poor guy couldn't get a word out. But he would pick up a guitar. We were hippie days. Everyone had guitars. And he'd pick up a guitar and he was dead fluent, completely fluent, completely fluent. So and that's very, very, very common, very, very common. Just to stress that the main thing we have found in terms of the individual is actually identifying very, very precisely the nature of the block and unraveling it and seeing where that takes you. And it's really a burden for people who stutter. It's a very harsh disorder that I think isn't appreciated enough. It's a really difficult thing to have. And most cultures are not particularly sympathetic towards it, and particularly in our busy West, where you go up to a shopkeeper and it takes you 2 minutes to actually ask for a loaf of bread or whatever it is, then people get irritated with you, people think you're bonkers, all of those things. So, and as I mentioned earlier, the bullying, the humiliation, the public humiliation is absolutely huge.
It's really a world work issue. You know, it's really it's a kind of a marginalization that is rarely talked about, mm-hmm. And it's there's an incredible amount of oppression. Like you're talking about glass ceilings and bullying and stuff like that, and that then all gets internalized. So one of the things that we love to do in our workshops was to do group processes with these groups of people who stutter on this kind of marginalization, and people talking about also the internalized depression, people starting to speak up about how upset they were with themselves about it. And
the first time we did a group process, I was so touched, because I find it can sound very trite to talk about internalized depression. You know, it can become another, and you need to work on your internalized depression, you know, and to really enter the bath together around just how very painful it is and how that attitude and frustration and self-loathing would actually come up, and that position of, which I felt you really demonstrated, that position of eldership around sympathy to all of the parts, the part that wants to speak, the part that's suffering, the part that puts one down, and all of this thing.
Like in a group process, are stutterers, like, are they kind of, do they support each other, or is there hierarchies within the stuttering community?
They're hugely supportive of each other.
So in a group process, would there be also issues that would come up right in the moment between, like, impatience with listening or...
No, I mean, actually the opposite. There's a sort of golden rule that thou shalt not interrupt somebody in the middle of a stutter, which sometimes is oppressive.
Yeah.
There's one man I can think of who has an extremely, extremely severe stutter in one of the self-help groups that I was working with in Edinburgh. And it would take him forever to say the simplest sentence. That's, you know, when you start thinking of the power dynamics in there, it gets very complicated. And people began over time in some of these evening groups to talk about these dynamics coming up in their relationships with their spouses. You know, when the topic was hot, they were more likely to stutter, and then the partner was going to feel frustrated if they can't just shout back because they're in the middle of a block, you know. So these complex dynamics were really beginning to be addressed again.
But I just wanted to pick up on what you said, Anne, because it wouldn't be that in the moment somebody was putting somebody else down for stuttering, but what we would do often, like in any group process, would be to represent the oppressive role. Mm-hmm. So they got to stand over here and be the one who's putting them down. And being able to represent that was incredibly freeing.
For them. Loved it.
Being able to represent it and then being able to be on the other side and react to that finally. And in a facilitated environment to objectify it, to meta-communicate about it, and also then pick up some of the gold in the oppressive side too, because there, you know, that kind of freedom to be able to speak or that kind of power is something that actually they needed to. That's a non-local thing that's usually just seen over there, but to be able to pick that part up.
Just to also add, in the UK, we've had quite a lot of interest with the people who work specifically with people who stammer in the UK. But actually what comes back over and over again, most of them at the end of the day want to be fluent.
Well,
most of the people who stutter want to be fluent.
That's, you know, and working with this, with that, is the challenge. I mean,
the challenge is to both honor the desire, the real desire for healing, to get rid of the symptom, and to honor the symptom itself and what it's trying to unfold and what it's trying to bring. So kind of that eldership of being able to hold both of those things, and that's
key.
A lot of what our work has been about.
Mm.
One of the things about the relationship with the normal speech and language therapist or speech pathologist community, that I really appreciated that working with you and working with also Jan, we should mention.
Jan Anderson.
Anderson.
And Carolyn. I mean, a whole bunch of them were involved with
us. There's a bunch of speech and language therapists over there in the UK who were coming to our workshops and helping us. And Jan, we would co-teach together. And so it was kind of seeing it from both sides. It was really a rainbow medicine approach, and we were learning from them, and they were learning from us. And so,
nice.
Yeah.
Okay. We should let these people go.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Thank you. Thanks.